Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is historian, editor, and author Gray Ostren. Ostren has a degree in American history and literature from Radcliffe and a PhD in American civilization from Brown. She has worked as a historian in both Massachusetts and New York, and she is the author of Bonds of Community, The Lives of Farm Women in 19th Century New York. And the book that we'll be discussing today is called Putting the Barn Before the House, Women in Family Farming in Early 20th Century New York, and it was published by Cornell University Press. I'm speaking to Gray Ostren by phone from her home in Massachusetts. Gray Ostren, thank you so much for joining us. I want to start with the fact that you describe yourself as a social historian interested in people's everyday lives. So what made you focus on women farmers in early 19th and 20th century New York?
There are two things I can say about that. What I should say first, however, is that I'm not a farmer's daughter, even remotely. Uh-huh. And so it is more accidental than it is a matter of family history. There are a lot of people who study rural women who grew up on farms. I'm not one of them. But as an undergraduate in Massachusetts, I worked at Old Sturbridge Village, which was a living historical museum and an outdoor history museum, in the period of the early 19th century, and I got to work in costume, and I didn't like explaining furniture, but I really loved being outdoors and on the Freeman Farm, which was set in 1837 and had old breeds of animals and a huge garden that was sufficient to feed the Freeman family. We knew about them through a winter, and I was not so clever at spinning and weaving and sewing and those sorts of things that women did. But I really got interested in the farm work and learned to milk cows and to make butter and cheese and gather eggs and feed the chickens and all of those things that women did. But then it became clear to me that from reading women's diaries that actually in the early 19th century, young women and some older women in New England worked outdoors. They helped in haying. They worked in the harvest. They worked alongside men and didn't always do the same work, but they were all out there. You needed everyone at times of haying and harvest. And when there were no men in the family available to work, we found particularly the diaries of two sisters, Sally and Pamela Brown. They went out and plowed, and they hayed, and they tried to get a hired man to help them, but couldn't. They supported their mother and ran this farm for some time. So I was fascinated by that, and I actually did, you know, learn how to tuck up the long skirt of my calico dress and go out and help turn the hay so it would dry in the field and then load it on the wagon and then stack it on the haystack. They never let me use the scythe because there were always enough men around on the farm staff to do that work. But I loved working outdoors, and I was really taken with the idea that even in early 19th century New England, middle-class women, I mean, these were landowning farmers, were not confined to the parlor and the kitchen.
You know, that surprised me. While I was reading the book, I was shocked. Because the stereotype, of course, is women in the kitchen in aprons and never venturing outside except to collect eggs.
Right. And I think a lot of people have that stereotype. I'm not sure where it comes from. It may come from large-scale grain farms in the upper Midwest and in the West, where the planting and everything was highly mechanized. There has been, in parts of the United States and parts of Europe, a kind of taboo on women operating large-scale farm machinery. Mm-hmm. But in upstate New York, women who were used to working in the fields, as many were, learned to drive tractors. And even some women in families who couldn't afford tractors, Hattie Bieber Smith in particular is particularly amusing. She took the family's Model T, hooked up the hay rake behind it, and drove through the fields to rake the hay. She was looking ahead, of course, where she was going, with the children looking out through the back window over the back seat to tell her if the rake got tangled with anything and so forth. There's one photograph in the book showing a woman, a very sturdy woman, standing with a hay fork in her hand. Her husband is on top of the stack of hay on the wagon. I didn't at the time that book went to press knew who those people were, but when I showed a slide of this photograph in the community, a woman suddenly jumped up and said, "But those are my parents."
Wow.
And these were Armenian immigrants who arrived in the early 20th century and farmed. Two brothers, also married Armenian women, went back and found them in an orphanage in Greece and brought them to this small rural community. They were very well accepted. They happened to be Protestant. They were very well accepted in the community. And so these were the Tartanians. And Alice Tartanian said, "I recognize those people." So,
God, how amazing that must have been. Now, Gray, let's talk about the focus of your book. It's in the Natticoke Valley.
Right.
In the Broome County area, which is in our region. So set the scene of what it was like in the early 20th century.
Well, let me just locate you first.
Mm-hmm.
These are the towns that anyone who has been to the Broome County airport would have seen at close range from the plane if the weather was good. If you think about the Susquehanna River, which goes along close to the southern border of New York State there, Broome County is sitting right there. Next to it is Tioga County. Tompkins, of course, where Ithaca is a little bit to the north. Cortland County, Shenango County, if you move just one county up from the river from west to east. Those are all fairly similar landscapes. But Broome County is particularly distinguished by having quite a lot of quite poor quality land. So that really by the 1880s and 90s, people who had cleared land and planted crops on that rich soil that was left from the trees were very disappointed because yields were going down very rapidly. The land eroded easily. It was a very poor quality soil in the upland areas in particular. If you were right on the base of the valleys where the Nanticoke Creek runs parallel to the Owego Creek, then you had some fertile soil, but it's not your best. You couldn't grow wheat there. You couldn't really grow cash crops. So as soon as the railroad came through in the 19th century, people began keeping dairy cows. The pastures are reasonably good. You could grow a lot of hay there. You couldn't grow much grain. People were doing a kind of extensive dairy farming, where the cattle would go out on the pasture in the summer. You only milked in the summer, and then the milk was usually made into butter and cheese.
Mm-hmm.
And people did that processing of their milk at home initially, and some continued to do so once you could get a hand-cranked separator. But a lot of families joined the Grange and joined cooperatives so that by the turn of the century, they were able to get decent prices for their milk through cooperative processing. And then the Dairymen's League was organized in this region before the First World War and negotiated with the New York City milk dealers so that these farmers were then shipping fluid milk, but through a co-op. So they were able to keep fairly small herds of cows, two dozen maybe cows, and make a living. Not a great living, and it couldn't be your only source of income. But they managed for a long time to keep family-sized farms employing almost no hired labor.
God, that's amazing. Now let's go back to what we were talking about. You know, the flexibility of gender norms, which surprised me. But you still talk about the fact that most men didn't do housework. So it was kind of a one-way street, right?
It was. And initially I thought, well, that's just not fair, right?
Right.
I was struck in the 19th century by the fact that men, particularly who'd been soldiers in the Civil War, they did know how to cook, they could sew their own shirts. But that appears to decline somewhat for the younger generations. Men did a lot of taking care of children. That's very clear.
That was a surprise, too.
Yeah. But beyond that, really, the men were outdoors and in the barn doing work that varied seasonally. And when children were old enough, then they might go with their dads, daughters as well as sons, especially older daughters, or if there were only daughters and no sons. But men didn't tend to do housework. They would work on spring cleaning. They would paint. They would do plumbing, those sorts of things that require handyman skills.
Mm-hmm.
But women, on the other hand, were always expected and usually willing to set aside whatever housework or sewing there was to go outside, to go to the barn morning and evening, to milk, to go outside and work with anything that needed to be done. And when I asked women who lived their lives like this why that was, trying very carefully not to assume that they found this oppressive or that they loved to do it one way or the other, just to hear what they said, they would say to me, well, of course, it was completely natural because that work paid. And the housework was just the housework, and you could do it on a rainy day. And if you had a slightly dirty parlor, who cared? The important thing was to get the chickens plucked to take to market or to do the milking or to get in the hay, because that was your source of income.
And that's exactly why you titled your book, Putting the Barn Before the House, right?
It is. Because if you then ask them why they had nice big barns and quite small houses, and why when they improved anything, when they had any spare money to invest, they would put it in something like a water system, which would serve the barn, help cool the milk, as well as in the house, but otherwise invest the money in the barn, in livestock, in farm equipment, machinery, generators for electricity, and so on, they would say, well, that was the source of your money. And I knew as much about the barn work, and I did half of it anyway, and I kept the books on the farm also, which I was startled by, even before income tax, women were keeping the farm accounts. And so I knew what the farm needed, and I was always happy to put that first.
God, that's amazing. You start talking a little bit about the fact that a lot of farms did not pay enough to keep the families, you know, in a good state of living. So a lot of people went to factory jobs and stuff. Talk to us about that, because you also talk about it's the age-old problem. Women always got paid less than men, even if they were going out to factories and doing the same kind of work.
That's correct. And they were very aware of this, because the Nanticoke Valley in the towns of Nanticoke and Maine are close enough to the Triple Cities, Binghamton, Johnson City, and Endicott, which in the early 20th century were booming manufacturing villages, actually. And it was very easy to get a job. And during World War I, they started running a workers' bus up Route 26, the main drag through the Nanticoke Valley. And you could get up in the morning and milk the cows, and then go change your clothes, get on the bus, and go to Endicott Johnson and work in the factory. And then go home in the afternoon and change your clothes and go to the barn and milk the cows. Students also did this. It was possible for you to stay then living with your parents and go to high school in Union and get a further education. In families, it varied enormously who worked on the farm and who worked off the farm. Sometimes the men worked off the farm and the women did all the milking and most of the routine farm work every day. And in other families, the men liked the farming and the women liked to work in the factory, and so they did. But they were very conscious that when you worked on the farm, what you got in exchange for that work was the price of the commodity, the price of the milk, the price of whatever it is that you produced. And when you worked in the factory, no matter how good you were, and you were paid piece rates, so you made more money the more quickly you could do your operation on, say, a shoe, you never earned more than half of what men did. And if women did start to earn as much as the men, they would just cut the piece rates for the jobs the women were on. They were very aware that their work, if it was not gender stereotyped, right, if it couldn't be seen as work that women did, was not devalued, and that the rest of the labor market, the wage labor market for women, was one in which they were tremendously disadvantaged.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Gray Ostrom. We're talking about her book, Putting the Barn Before the House, Women and Family Farming in Early 20th Century New York, and it was published by Cornell University Press. Now, Gray, I want to talk specifically. I was very intrigued by this unusual couple called Hattie and Edmund Smith. So shocked to hear that they were liberal. They liked classical music. You know, I got caught up in all the stereotypes of what farmers were like. And this, to tell us about them.
they were, as you might know by the number of pages that I devoted to them in this manuscript, they were a family that I adored and that I got to know very well. And I think in any community, this couple would be extraordinary, urban, rural, or otherwise. Hattie Bieber-Smith was from further north in the Mohawk Valley from a German-American family. She was older when they married. She had gone to high school. She had gotten a teaching certificate and taught school. So she was well-educated. And her husband was from a family that had owned this farm in the town of Maine, the southern part of the town of Maine, for many generations, but was also very interested in the world, very literate, always subscribed to newspapers, went to the World's Fair in Chicago in the 1890s on a train, you know, because they wanted to be cosmopolitan in this way. The most striking thing to me about this couple is that I almost always spoke with them together. Everything they did, they wanted to do together.
Mm-hmm.
They talked over everything in a very open-minded way. He was a wonderful listener. He would defer to her and say, well, why don't you explain this because this is how you felt? And she would say, well, Edmund thought blah, blah. They raised their children also to discuss anything and everything. And when they found the local church somewhat narrow-minded for their taste and somewhat overly strict, they would go and observe the Sabbath by walking in the woods and talking about nature.
God, they're early
God,
hippies. Right? God, it's unbelievable.
They were amazing people. And, of course, they were involved in community organizations, both in the Nanticoke Valley and in the town of Union and Johnson City, where they took the children to the library. When they took the milk down, they would go and get library books. And they were active in the Dairymen's League and continued to be for decades and went on international farm tours to places where there were other farm cooperatives in Europe, in Asia, in Latin America.
God, that's amazing.
Well, I guess in the early 20th century, these were people who grew up at a time when there wasn't a huge amount of economic opportunity. They were from families that did not have the money to send them to college. And so they made a life on the farm, and they appreciated being able to be independent, to live on their own schedules, to think their own thoughts, to not have too many neighbors. They thought cities were crowded and everybody spent all their time rushing around and never could stop to breathe the air and appreciate the seasons and think their own thoughts or even have time to reflect. And the children they raised, who are now all of them quite old, whom I still know, every one of them became a farmer or a professional in something.
That's a truly like almost a new age story amid this book about the early 20th century. I couldn't believe it.
They were moderns, and they were farmers, but they always were very up to date in terms of new technologies and machinery, but also very community spirited, and they always exchanged work with their neighbors, some of whom had less machinery than they did, but more helping hands. And they believed in mutual aid and cooperation and were among the people who had no reservations about the Southern and Eastern European immigrants who moved into their neighborhood and were very welcoming and very inclusive and shared their information about what grew well on what kinds of land and so on.
Yeah, they really were an amazing couple. Now, you know what else I was surprised by? We think of farmers as independent spirits, too, in many ways.
Yes.
And they started some of these incredible co-ops and institutions, which we've been talking about, you know, the grain Broome County Farm Bureau, the Dairymen's League. Talk to us about how they were able to cooperate like that.
I have thought about that a lot because farmers do have a reputation as being really independent with a capital I and competing with one another. And I've spent a lot of time talking with people, older people in the community. This is even in the 1980s, and they were old then. Some of them were born in the 1890s. And what they said was that if you thought you could survive by yourself as a farming family, you had to be crazy. That everyone had to help everyone else. And it wasn't just in emergencies like when the barn burned or when someone got sick. But really, it was a part of daily life because you would engage in this process that the men at least called changing work, right? In haying season, the key thing about haying is that you have to cut the hay while the sun shines, get it dried over a couple of days, and then get it in the barn before it gets rained on.
If
this was before silos and before the time you were fermenting silage or anything, that takes a lot of hands all at once in the field, and no one could do that by themselves. So you would form a little haying ring, and all the farmers in the neighborhood would start on one farm and then go to the next and the next and the next through the season, so that if you had a larger amount of land, you might contribute some more labor. But nobody kept count of it, so it wasn't like anybody was hiring anybody else. You just made sure that you contributed as much work as you got from the group of your neighbors. The same thing happened at harvest. And when people started buying machinery, they also, in some cases, owned it cooperatively. Or you could bring your team and your machine and use it on someone else's field, and then they would come with their hand labor to help you until it balanced out. And this was just part of daily life.
So cooperation happened because of necessity.
They said so, and I believed them. And it was a routine part of daily life. The women didn't even keep track. The women just acted as though they were responsible for one another, and when someone needed help, you went or you sent a daughter or you called your sister or whatever. When I studied the diaries from this community in the late 19th century, and I did that first in terms of the research process, I also came to realize that when this community was being settled by farming families from New England, other parts of New York, and some people came up from Pennsylvania, they tended to get large tracts of land and then divide it up over the generations so that brothers might be farming next door. Cousins eventually were on adjacent farms. And then people tended to marry the girl next door, right? So that these neighborhoods were knit together by kinship, by extended family ties. As late as 1900, you could trace them. People might be second cousins, but believe me, they knew how they were related to one another. And then that set the norms, the kind of expectations of how you behave in a neighborhood. And when unrelated people moved in, you just brought them into this whole system. Right.
Oh, that's amazing to me.
And they expected to behave in the same way. So, for instance, I mean, the Northfield family, Carrie Northfield was, I thought, particularly remarkable because she was a single woman and was a teacher and a farmer, farmed cooperatively with her brother and his wife and with another sister who also never married. They came into this community because their mother, who was from Binghamton and had a little money that she inherited, married a landless farmer who was living with his sister and working with his brother-in-law. They then bought a farm in the town of Nanticoke. So they were newcomers, but they had one kin tie, and then very quickly they just became absorbed by this entire network of people who changed work. And they ended up passing the farm down to the next generation of brothers and then finally cousins. That farm still exists.
Those are remarkable ties. But before we run out of time, I want to ask you this question. What did you learn from this extensive research about the lives of women that surprised you for that era?
I think I learned that women in the past were far more conscious of their position and of what made women vulnerable and what gave women a position of strength than I ever assumed. They tended to think that it was hard to be an independent woman, but some, and not to marry, but some women could manage. But that for most women, the important thing was to have an equal relationship with your husband. And you earned that in part by working hard and being a good cooperator, but you also did that by standing up for yourself, that the most important thing was not to get abused or walked on or stepped on in any way. And they were very aware of how that could happen if men drank to excess or if they grew up in families where women were disrespected. You had to be careful. People were warned away from, you know, oh, you shouldn't think about going out with anybody whose last name is X because those men drink and they abuse their wives and they work in the woods and sometimes they have relationships with young women that result in illegitimate children and they don't do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no stigma attached to being a daughter in a family like that. If a young woman growing up in a family like that went to the district school and held her head up and behaved in a respectable way, people would hire her to come and live in their houses in some cases, to be a live-in child care worker, be a farm helper, and help them finish high school.
Wow.
And there was also some sense that if you knew that a woman was being beaten, it was your responsibility to help her if she wanted to be helped. And the women talked about this, and the men talked about this. And in some cases, I mean, I remember one case of a village school teacher who married a man who was from somewhere else when she was in her 40s. And it became clear that he drank and that when he was drunk, he sometimes hit her. And the neighbors, once when they heard screams coming from their house, the men showed up with an axe and told him that if they ever heard her shrieking again or saw her with bruises, they would not give him any warnings.
Wow, wow. Gray, we're almost out of time. Can you give some contact information? Do you have a website or any?
I don't. I can tell you that the book, Putting the Barn Before the House, is available from Amazon and at the general store and several other places in the town of Maine. It's in bookstores also in Ithaca and in Owego and in Whitney Point. And it should, I hope, inspire people to talk with older folks in their own communities and in their own families. And I think that people will be very surprised by what they discover, that people in the past were very aware of relationships between women and men and the importance of mutual respect and equality. And quite ordinary people had their own ways of thinking about and addressing these questions. I was stunned and inspired and still feel this way.
Gray, we are out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. Again, the book is called Putting the Barn Before the House, Women and Family Farming in Early 20th Century New York. Thank you so much, Gray Ostrin.
Thank you, too.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.